7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. The program overseeing newly legalized medical marijuana is delayed. We'll hear more about why.
Why our lawmakers chose to go the route of processed pharmaceutical versions of cannabis, I can't answer that. It makes no sense to me, especially with the problems that we do have here with pharmaceuticals.
We'll have that story coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. A new report from Congress on the Congressional Budget Office shows increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour could boost the wages of 17 million workers. As Becca Schimmel reports, it could have a big impact in the Ohio Valley, where low-wage service sector jobs are increasing.
The new report shows raising the federal minimum wage could also lift more than 1 million people out of poverty. But the CBO warns that could also result in more than 1 million lost jobs and could diminish overall income for others. The report comes as congressional Democrats prepare to vote on the first increase in the federal minimum wage in a decade. Virginia Democrat Bobby Scott, who chairs the House Education and Labor Committee, says the CBO report makes a strong economic case for passing the Raise the Wage Act.
Raising the minimum wage will provide a boost in the economy by putting money in the pockets of workers who will spend that money in the economy.
Scott is pressing his caucus to increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour over the coming 5 years. The Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning think tank, conducted a separate analysis in February showing how the Ohio Valley region would be affected. EPI predicts that in large portions of eastern Kentucky, southern West Virginia, and southeast Ohio, roughly 40% of workers would see some increase in wages. EPI economist Ben Zipper says, in general, raising the minimum wage can help workers who earn the least, which he says are typically women and people of color.
Minimum wages, because they focus on the bottom of the wage distribution, they affect and raise wages for people who are the least paid in our economy, and those typically are women and people of color.
The Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, argues small businesses wouldn't be able to increase their revenue enough to cover the cost of higher wages. The group also said employers would be forced to increase prices or cut costs by laying people off. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Thousands of Ohio Valley residents live within one city block of highly pressurized underground natural gas storage wells, according to new research from Harvard University. Brittany Patterson has more.
The study published this week used satellite, census, and other land use data to map how close people in Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and three other states live to underground natural gas storage wells. These are often inactive oil and gas wells that have natural gas injected into them, but they can leak or explode, and they are not well regulated. In 2015, a California well leaked for 4 months, forcing the evacuation of more than 1,000 people. The new study found that 41% of active storage wells are located within 650 feet, or one city block, of a home. Drew McCanowitz is the study's lead author. He says living near active natural gas storage puts people at risk for being exposed to chemicals in natural gas, as well as possible gas explosions.
You know, our study can add to that discussion as well in the sense of there are risks. There are, you know, societal costs along the supply chain that, may not be fully understood yet.
The study was published in the journal Environmental Health. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:48. Areas of fog this morning, becoming mostly sunny, hot, and humid today. There's a slight chance of afternoon rain and thunderstorms with highs in the 80s and low 90s. Chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight with lows in the 60s and 70s. Rain and thunderstorms possible tomorrow with highs in the 80s. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by Taylor Books on Capitol Street in downtown Charleston. Bookstore, cafe, art gallery, gifts, and more on Facebook or at taylorbooks.com. Despite legislation from 2017 that allowed cannabis to be legal for medical use, West Virginia officials say they're still years away from the first sale. That's at least in part because of a hang-up with finding a banking solution to get around federal law. State health officials say they also have to implement permitting and licensing for patients and those who want to start businesses within the industry. Dave Mistich gives us a look at the stalled program and what's ahead to get it off the ground.
Late last month, the West Virginia Treasurer's Office released a statement indicating they were canceling and then reissuing a request for proposals for a depository associated with the medical cannabis program. An initial bid returned 5 applications, but none of the prospective banking vendors met all the requirements. Officials from the Treasurer's Office say they are now in a blackout period and cannot comment on the bidding process until a banking vendor has been selected. Delegate Mike Pushkin, a Democrat from Kanawha County, who has championed the legalization of cannabis, says the banking solution, which was spurred along through legislation that cleared in May, should push back the timeline another few months.
It's not such a big deal. These things happen a lot when we're bidding out to vendors in state government, that people don't meet all of the mandatory requirements of that bid. It's not uncommon. What's uncommon is that it's a bid that we're watching so closely.
But even if a banking vendor is awarded a contract in the next few months, officials from the State Department of Health and Human Resources say it could still be some time before cannabis is sold to patients. Here's Jason Frame, who directs the DHHR office that was created to oversee the program.
So the Office of Medical Cannabis, or OMC, continues to have a goal of 2 years from the time a banking solution is in place for patients with a serious medical condition to be able to obtain medical cannabis. And
Frame also points out that the July 1 date wasn't a deadline or a mandatory go-live date for medical cannabis in West Virginia, but rather a statutory marker that opened the door for the program. He also says DHHR has work of its own to do.
We're going to have a web-based permitting system. We're in contract right now for the design of that system. We're hiring staff. We're implementing policy and procedures, designing those procedures.
Frame says there's other work to do to get the products in the hands of patients, with West Virginia's medical cannabis law currently only allowing oils, creams, and other non-smokable forms of the plant. He says it will take some time to process the active ingredients to be consumed within the scope of the law.
Industry is going to have to be built out. Physical buildings are going to be put in place. Of course, crops will have to be grown. They'll have to be then processed into sellable products. Patients won't be able to buy the leaf form of medical cannabis. That's part of the act. So everything that's grown will have to be processed into a sellable product.
But some advocates for the program say West Virginia's medical cannabis law is weak. Rusty Williams is a patient advocate on the program's advisory board. The group, made up of health officials, law enforcement, and others, reports recommendations to the legislature and the governor's office.
We were tasked to look at whether or not to add or remove conditions to the accepted conditions list. We were charged with looking at whether or not to allow whole plant flower to be able, for patients to be able to access whole plant flower. And we were tasked with whether or not to allow businesses to vertically integrate. And we met those charges 2 years early.
As Williams points out, the only recommendation that has been codified by lawmakers has been the vertical integration provision, which allows a single business to act as a grower, a processor, and a distributor. An earlier version of the law would have limited operations within the industry. But Williams says small improvements to a fundamentally flawed program haven't been enough. While he's called for patients to be able to grow cannabis at home and use it how they see fit, he's frustrated that what West Virginia's law does allow hasn't yet come to fruition.
Why our lawmakers chose to go the route of, processed pharmaceutical versions of cannabis, I can't answer that. It makes no sense to me, especially with the problems that we do have here with pharmaceuticals.
Williams has also been bothered by what he considers obstructionist rhetoric from one of West Virginia's federal prosecutors.
It's frustrating to know that there's only one state in the country where we have a federal prosecuting attorney actively going after the cannabis industry, and that's right here in the hills of West Virginia.
Williams is referring to U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia, Mike Stewart. The Trump-appointed prosecutor has been a vocal opponent of the legalization of cannabis, arguing that research is unclear on the drug's potential benefits and drawbacks in a medical or recreational setting. But Stewart says he doesn't make the law. He simply enforces it.
I think on this whole issue of marijuana, it's pretty clear. This is an issue of public policy that's going to be solved by public officials, and whether that's Congress or other folks who have the authority to do that. My job, though, as a U.S. attorney, is to enforce federal law.
But last month, the U.S. House of Representatives adopted an amendment to a federal appropriations bill that would prohibit the Department of Justice from interfering with state cannabis programs. The bill still needs to clear the Senate, but since December 2014, Congress has blocked the Justice Department from targeting businesses and individuals in states where cannabis is legal. Still yet, Stewart says he will take a look at things on a case-by-case basis and would prosecute as necessary.
But it's not as simple as saying because it's related to medicinal marijuana, there's no enforcement. Prescription pharmaceuticals are legal. OxyContin, under the right circumstances, is illegal. It is legal. However, if there is a pharmacist or a doctor that is misprescribing those drugs in a way that is not medically necessary or medically ethical, we prosecute those folks all the time. And so there's no area of the law that says that there won't be enforcement when there are abuses.
Regardless of Stewart saying he will keep a close eye on the rollout of the medical cannabis program, the state treasurer and the DHHR appear to be moving forward. Pushkin, though, says he hopes health officials get to work quickly in terms of permitting and licensing.
I don't understand why they would have to wait for the banking program to be in place for them to at least put out the applications, start issuing cards to patients. You know, we put something in that bill that would allow for reciprocity for patients, just, you know, foreseeing that there could be some hiccups along the way.
For now, patients here can legally acquire medical cannabis in other states, but only the acceptable forms under the West Virginia law. Frame and others at DHHR say they are working diligently to get their processes in place for those who want to enter the industry or use cannabis for medical purposes without traveling out of state.
We are definitely sympathetic to their concerns. And we appreciate the support from the governor's office and also the hard work that's been done in the legislature to put a workable form of the Medical Cannabis Act out there. However, it is complicated. There's a lot of provisions and a lot of complications that go along with that process. But everyone involved has been working hard to roll out products as soon as possible.
The state treasurer's office says they have shortened the bidding timeline for potential banking vendors from 6 weeks to 4.5 weeks to expedite the process. Bids will be accepted through July 31st. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.